welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And it's kind of been a bit of that time of year, Jem. The hay fever has started coming in something terrible. I'm going to be honest, I love performing outside, but the grass gets right in my face, gets right up my nose, has my eyes streaming. And there are days when I really, really struggle because I get it quite bad. My eyes swell up. I can barely see to juggle. And it makes me wonder how people in the past would have coped with, you know, something like this. And the answer is, of course, for the most part, they were big, tough people and they weren't, you know, big girls, blousers, jugglers that went round going, oh, I've got a bit of hay fever. But my point, Jem, is that this week, I don't know what my point was.
It sounded like you just wanted to whine a little bit, but, you know, you keep going.
Do you know what? It's going to be one of those episodes. I'm warning you now, Jem, I am going to be whining in this episode. About everything, and in particular about disease. You suggested this subject. You want to talk about how disease changed history.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure. Hay fever is an allergy rather than a disease. I don't think you can catch hay fever, but, you know.
I did also have a cold recently that nearly finished
off. On a very serious point. So when you're looking at disease, it could be one of the big pandemics. We've already mentioned the Spanish flu, the influenza outbreak that happened right at the end of World War One. You mentioned a cold. People often confuse colds with influenza, the flu. The flu is not the same thing as a cold. You know, colds can lay you low for a few days, but flu will put you in a bed for a week. Now, this particular form of flu ended up killing tens of millions of people. And, you know, there's the Black Death. Everybody's heard of that one too. But you know what? I'm going to say that there are illness, sickness, disease is just a constant background in pretty much any bit of history you want to talk about. It took us until the late 19th century to come up with the idea of germ theory, of these microscopic things that were probably leading to infections. In the mid-Victorian era, Victorian surgeons would have really dirty, sort of blood-crusted coats on to show to everybody what a good surgeon they were. And of course, nowadays we know that's just spreading infection everywhere. So generally, if you ever had surgery prior to the era of sterilization, it was 50-50 at best. Maybe they could operate on you and fix you up, but you then might die of a horrific infection afterwards. And there are lots of other examples of how disease has affected human history, but that's me just kicking things off. Over to you.
I think one thing we're going to have to make clear is we're not going to try in this episode, or as far as I'm aware, we're not going to try in this episode to make this a history of medicine. You know, medicine through time.
Absolutely not. We're not qualified for that.
We're not qualified, but more than that, it's just an entirely different subject. We can go back and we can trace it from, you know, the four humours and how they discovered different things and how different people learnt different things about medicine and carried that on through. But I think far more interesting, far more what we're going to try and take point on is specific ways in which diseases themselves have played a part on history. And you've already mentioned some of the big ones, but let's not forget a tiny little outbreak. It doesn't have to be. In fact, it only takes one person to get ill. And if it's the right person, it can put a massive, massive change on history. Whether that is an illness that affects the mental functions, if that happens as it has happened several times throughout history to a member of a royal family or a dictator or some sort, that can completely throw an entire country off track. Or if there's somebody that's needed for some reason and they are ill at a crucial moment, that can equally change the course of history. And I think that really is more the line we're going down today. Is that right?
Absolutely. You just mentioned there sort of a key person. Now, we've gone backwards and forwards on many occasions about King Arthur. But here's the thing. Britain, well, specifically England, very nearly did have a real King Arthur, because Arthur was the older brother of Henry VIII. He was the guy who married Catherine of Aragon, and he died. Well, both of them came down with this thing called sweating sickness. We know very little about it, apart from it was clearly very virulent, very easy to catch. It seemed to affect people in the 1500s and 1600s in Western Europe. It wasn't just Britain. It was also France and other places as well. And that's all we know. It broke out very quickly. It killed a whole bunch of people. And then it disappeared just as quickly as it sort of broke out. And it just stopped coming back. We really don't know much about it. But Arthur was killed by it. Now, he was about 15 at the time. He was sort of a teenager. He was a fit young man. There was no reason why he wouldn't have perhaps gone on to have ruled England. Now, if he had, how hugely different would British history have been at that point? Because, of course, Henry VIII split from the Catholic Church over his marriage to Catherine of Aragon. And you know, the whole Tudor dynasty would have been completely different. So maybe more stability would have happened in Britain. Maybe we would never have broken from the Catholic faith in Britain. This is just because of one man dying of an illness.
And it's interesting that that's the one you should bring up first, because it reminds me of a legend, or shall we say, a completely made-up story about Queen Elizabeth I. I don't know if you know the tale of the Bisley Boy.
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, the Bisley Boy, this is a Cotswold legend. It's one that I first heard about when I was up in Sudley Castle. And this legend goes that Henry VIII, obviously, he wasn't there all the time to look after Queen Elizabeth. And for a while when she was growing up, Queen Elizabeth was sent off to the Cotswolds. And while she was up there, the story goes that she caught a serious disease and she died. And that King Henry was coming up to visit.
Well, I was not expecting that in the story.
There you go.
That's a twist.
Story goes, King Henry's coming up to visit. What are they going to do? Oh, big idea. There's this boy in the village that was good friends with Queen Elizabeth. If they stick him in a dress and he doesn't say anything, King Henry probably won't notice. The story then goes on that as it carries on, he grows up and he is actually Queen Elizabeth. And, you know, they reference various different things, you know, various different bits and pieces, you know, her speeches and the fact that she was the virgin queen and she never married and all of this, all as taken as evidence that she is not actually Queen Elizabeth at all, but a boy dressed up. And it's one of those things where it sounds incredibly funny and it sounds like an incredibly silly story. And that's partly because it is, but also because disease strikes. And put yourself in the shoes of someone. Imagine that was a true circumstance. You've been given charge of a royal child, and then disease strikes at the wrong time, just as they're about to be visited. And it can be simple things like that that could then, if Henry had turned up and Queen Elizabeth had died, that entire family would be outcast. Who knows what he would have done? So when we're thinking about history, and as you say, the sort of the what-if idea of if Arthur had lived, let's also forget there are so many times throughout history where people got ill and they recovered. And as you talked about, with the knowledge of disease not being the best, a lot of the time they recovered more by luck than anything else. There are so many times when history could have been completely altered by someone becoming ill rather than just by the fact that people became ill that could have survived.
Oh, yeah, undoubtedly. Now, the sad fact is, this is the depressing bit, people. I'm going to ask Greg this. Do you know what the single biggest killer of humans has been throughout the whole of history? And it's not war.
No. Is it going to be childbirth?
I like where you're going from there. It's a disease. It's a specific disease that's still with us today.
Oh. In that case, it's got to be... Well, it can't be the common cold. That's too simple. Would it be the flu, something like that?
No, it isn't. Sadly, it's malaria. It's killed billions, and it still kills each year. It's estimated between 1 and 2 million people. So basically, every 5 years or so, the entire casualties of World War One are wiped out by malaria alone. So you can see why people like Bill Gates has the Gates Foundation is spending millions, tens of millions, trying to eradicate malaria. Because if we could do that, that would be make a huge difference on planet Earth. But the thing about most of these illnesses is they affect the young. So, you know, you'll think about childbirth. Obviously, let's not get too into it, but childbirth lays a woman out for potential attack from bacteria. So that's why, you know, pre-antibiotics era, you know, dying in birth was probably about 10% of the time. It's just a horrific thing. You know, it's a death sentence in theory, being able to bring life to the world. Then, of course, young children, they're far more prone to be affected by diseases. You're more likely to recover as a grown man or woman. And I know that it's basically, it's considered that up until the age of about 7, you know, they are vulnerable. Children are vulnerable to illnesses and things like that. After the age of 7, of course, what's really the difference between an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old? There isn't huge amounts of difference, but by then you've kind of been around long enough to have resisted some of the common illnesses out there, and you're considered more robust. And then if you flip it the other way, in Britain today, if you die under the age of 70, it's considered suspicious in the sense that it needs to be explored. You shouldn't be dying at 69 or 68. You know, you know, basically once you're into your 70s, that's sort of the time where you might again become more susceptible to illnesses and things like that, just because, you know, your body isn't as robust as it used to be. So when you factor that in, no wonder, you know, there weren't a lot of cavemen who were living into their 80s, because illness, infection was almost invariably going to get you at some point. And, you know, the thing with malaria is the way malaria is spread. It's obviously through mosquitoes, but mosquitoes breed in still water. Running water, they can't, their eggs will just be washed away. So a lot of it's really unglamorous. We all know about the bubonic plague and Spanish flu and things like that, but it's things like cholera and malaria that have killed billions. And it's dirty water, because water is so important to us. Dirty water will kill us, basically.
I think one thing that started to occur to me there was that when we're talking about how disease have changed history, and without going into a whole history of medicine thing, what we have to think about is how the overcoming of disease is also changing history in its own way. When you talk about disease and disease spreading and still water and infection, what I started to think about was the way that the world used to be more spread out. Obviously, we go back before the Industrial Revolution. People were spread out.
I think you're going to have to explain that a little bit, because the world is surely the same size, Greg.
Okay, if we're being facetious, the people in the world were a bit more spread out. There were fewer people in the world as well. But if we go back before the Industrial Revolution, people lived in much, much smaller areas, villages, hamlets. A lot of the time, we get plague villages, places that were just cut off completely because there was illness, because there was disease there, and people didn't want to catch it. Now, once we get the Industrial Revolution, one of the things that starts to happen is people gather together, they live in closer confinement. Now, had they not started to figure out ways to overcome disease in close quarters, had we not figured out things like clean water had an effect, then sooner or later we would have reached a mass population size. And now we're continuing to do it. We continue to overcome disease. And as we overcome disease, that allows people to live in closer and closer quarters without killing each other off. We're not in a situation now where, fingers crossed, you know, touch wood, occasionally we get the odd outbreak. we get some pandemics, but we're not in a situation now, generally speaking, where when one person gets an illness of some sort, that it immediately spreads around and kills off an entire city full of people. Luckily, we have medical practice. We've overcoming disease in that way. Whereas in the past, that wouldn't be possible. And so I think that part of the look of how disease has changed history, you have to look at how overcoming disease changes history. And it allows this industrialization to happen. It allows people to gather together in larger and larger numbers. It allows for cities, and it really works on a double effect. One, because we're reducing disease, we're increasing our population. And then because we're reducing disease and our population increases, we can put people closer and closer together. And I think that is an important thing to bear in mind, that in the past, disease was, you know, depending how you want to look at this as a good or a bad thing, disease was a form of population control. It stopped the population skyrocketing. The more we get control over disease, the more the population will just keep growing and growing and growing, and that has to have an effect on the world and on history.
Well, yeah, I mean, let's not get too heavy about this or make us sound almost like, you know, final solution or anything like that, but you're quite right. It's you can clearly map the fact that as we've got better with disease control, the population, particularly in the 20th century, which is about the same time we started getting antibiotics, has hugely jumped up. You know, we're now at 7 billion human beings on planet Earth. You only have to go back 150 years and it was more like, you know, 1 billion people on planet Earth. What's changed? Medicine, basically. So, and also food production's got a bit better. But what I wanted to sort of throw out there is that you're also talking about you couldn't have the Industrial Revolution, and I absolutely hear you there. It's interesting that sanitation, basic sanitation, it changed places like Manchester, which were little towns, and then over the space of one generation, because they started opening up the factories, it was jumping from roughly about 12,000 people to 120,000 people. I mean, it's a ridiculous amount of growth. The sewers couldn't cope with it. Loads of people started dying from cholera. Let's get some drains and sewers into there. Bazalgette created the sewer system for London, and again saved tens of thousands of lives from not dying from dirty water. But the sheer genius of Bazalgette is he built the sewer system to be so big, it was ridiculously large for London in Victorian era, but he knew that the population would grow. And here we are in 2017 using the same sewer system, and it still isn't up to capacity. That's foresight. That's Victorian genius. But the other thing that happened in the Victorian era is the one area of planet Earth that hadn't been carved up by European powers. The Americas had been, Asia had been, Europe had been, Africa. Why was Africa the last continent to be imperialized, colonized, etc.? Because we were dying from illnesses. Africa has some of the nastiest diseases on planet Earth, and every time white guys turned up there, the locals just had to, you know, creep back into the bush. And then we would all die of malaria. So it was the invention of quinine that actually allowed the scramble for Africa, which is very much, you know, the second half of the 19th century was shaped by the European powers just carving up this continent, the dark continent, because they now could, which, you know, wasn't right at all, but suddenly, you know, might is right in a way, and they knew that they could get away with it. But finally, they had the medicine to stop themselves dying from just constantly turning up to Africa and sending everybody home in boxes.
It's one of those big problems we have with history, and we're going to talk about disease, so I'm just going to bring us down a little bit in the hope that in the last few minutes you'll have left to talk about this, you'll be able to bring the podcast back up a bit.
And I have a happy story as well, but yes,
brilliant.
Over to you.
You be ready with a happy story then, because when you're talking about that, what we're talking about is people facing different diseases. And this is one of the ways in which history really has been affected by disease, and that is different civilization, different cultures encountering each other for the first time. obviously one of the big examples we have of this is the Europeans going over to America, Columbus going over to America, and taking a host of diseases over to America with them, diseases that the Native Americans people had never encountered before and had no defenses for. They had no antibodies. Whereas the Europeans, a lot of these were simple diseases. They got all the antibodies. These were things that evolutionarily over generations people had come to deal with in Europe, and so they knew exactly how to deal with them. As soon as they went over to a new culture, a place where these illnesses had never been faced, they could do an awful lot of harm very, very quickly. And it's one of those things that people tend not to think about when you're setting out to explore. It's something we don't really think about when you watch a sci-fi program or something about the exploration of space or whatever. One of the worries that very rarely comes up, you hear people saying, should we go into space? You know, should mankind spread across the galaxies? Because we've got this problem of, you know, we tend to start wars and stuff like that. But, or the risk of bringing infection back here, the risk of what we, you know, crossing over different diseases and things like that when you're traveling around, it very rarely comes up. And I think it's been such a big thing in the history of the Earth that we really think about the fact that as you cross cultures, you cross diseases, and that the history of disease is not one solid thing running right across the planet. It's different in every part of the globe.
It's different in every part of the globe. It's different in different eras of history as well. And I think one of the reasons why Britain and Northern Europe has been able to build these huge empires is because fundamentally the illnesses in Europe haven't been as aggressive as the places of ones in Asia, South America, and Africa. It doesn't make the people there any better. It just happens to be that their climates are lousy for things like malaria. Although, interestingly, Oliver Cromwell, who is a man who never left the British Isles/Ireland, died of malaria. Nobody's quite, you know, it's mentioned as a sort of statement of fact, and it's like, yeah, it's malaria. Okay, but how did he die of malaria, considering he sort of never went to Java or somewhere like that? So, but yes, generally, these are quite safe places to live. Britain in particular, if you look at our wildlife, we don't have cougars. You know, we killed out our wolves centuries ago. So really, nowadays, the worst illness you could possibly get is the flu. And, you know, the biggest mauling you'd get is from a, you know, slightly irritable badger. This is a pretty, pretty bland place, and therefore a great place as a seat of power, of sort of a holding position, to launch an attack somewhere else. Anyway, but I wanted to give you the happy story. So after the Black Death, if you look at the plague, it was a huge concern from 1348 until roughly 1660s. It was the big one that nobody wanted to get, and they had no way to stop it. But after that, there was then, like, nature abhors a vacuum. What's the new big killer of humans? And it ended up being smallpox. Now, we've all heard of smallpox, and we assume that it was, you know, people in Middle Ages were just as worried about smallpox as they were about bubonic plague. No, it very much became a thing after the plague. Smallpox is very easy to catch. It's horrific. It ravages the bodies. You've heard of things like pockmarked. That's sort of big pits in your face. That's when the buboes go away. If you survive, you're hideously disfigured. It's horrible, horrible illness. And basically, the World Health Organization and the UN in the middle of the 20th century managed to track it down and sort of basically isolate it into a few spots. It started vaccinating everybody. We all get the cowpox. Jenner invented vaccination, realizing that people who'd had cowpox, which is a very minor form of smallpox, if they had that, they couldn't catch smallpox. So that's where the vaccination first came out. And basically, they managed to eradicate smallpox. Now, smallpox does exist, but it only exists in two laboratories, one in America and one in Russia. And there is the danger that it can be weaponized again. But in the natural world, we managed to eradicate, human beings managed to eradicate a very lethal virus to us. So well done, human beings. There are moments when we are using our science for good, and we've saved countless millions of lives by getting rid of smallpox.
We did indeed, you know, save thousands of lives. And I hate to bring it back, but the smallpox virus, as you say, it's eradicated apart from in those laboratories. Now, am I right? I seem to recall a story a couple of years ago on the news that somebody found some smallpox virus misidentified in a fridge in an old laboratory.
I don't remember that. I know that one person since then has died of smallpox. They were working in the same laboratory as, I can't remember whether it was America or Russia. Nobody's got a clue how they could have died from it, because it's obviously heavily guarded, heavily sealed. It wasn't like they went up there and licked the test tube or anything. Nobody was sure how they got it, but they did.
Here we go. You know, I have the story in front of me. I've managed to find it. This was after they were supposed to only have it in those two laboratories, super secure laboratories in Atlanta and in Russia. A government scientist cleaning out an old storage room at a research center near Washington made a startling discovery. Decades-old vials of smallpox packed away and forgotten in a cardboard box.
Excellent. Well, I hope they burnt them.
Well, I believe that they were no longer live virus, so there was less of a problem. It was all being dry froze. But the fact of the matter is, I've never quite understood, you know, obviously there's the fear of weaponization there, and, you know, presumably there is some argument that you need to have a sample of the disease in case you ever need to fight it again. But I just always think it's a little bit playing with fire to keep samples of eradicated diseases anywhere at all.
I can't argue with that.
And I think I've kind of gone onto a moral philosophy point there rather than sticking with the pure history. So shall we do a very, very quick what if before we finish up?
Okay, yes. I guess it's a slightly sad what if. What if there had never been any cowboys?
Oh, okay. That sounds really sad. Well, the first question is, if there had never been any cowboys, is why were there never any cowboys? It's such an obvious thing to do. And the only answer I can think of is because...
Just for the record, the cowboy era only lasted for about 20 years. It barely happened, and it's just been mythologized ever since. The movies have lasted longer than the era of the cowboy. So I'm sure they could have come up with some other way to move cows across America. But then what on earth are we going to be writing about and stuff? But anyway, yes, back over to you.
Okay, and I'm sure those cowboys still working in America at the moment would appreciate the fact that you've told them that they've been completely wiped out from history, like a cardboard box full of smallpox. But the fact of the matter is, if there hadn't been cowboys, there'd only be one good reason for that, and that was because, like a lot of jobs in history, men would have gone, not really for us, that's women's work. How great would it have been if cowboy had been a job that had been given almost exclusively to women? You know, in that era, in the Victorian era, you turn to women and you go, you've got a choice. You can be a school teacher or a nurse or a cowgirl. And I think that probably would have started feminism much, much earlier. No cowboys, all of these strong women riding across the plains, rounding up cattle, doing the old lassoing with the, it's not a lasso, is it? A lariat. Doing all of this, I think that had we not had cowboys, we would have had a female prime minister much, much sooner than Margaret Thatcher. And, you know, we probably would have just gone on to have loads and loads of female prime ministers. And I'm going to stop there because I've got a feeling that this episode is going to come out somewhere around the general election. And I don't want to make any more political comments at this point in time. So Cowboys would be gone. Cowgirls would be there. Everything would be great. No politics.
I have no idea how you managed to get from Cowboys to feminism to female political leaders. But well done. Well done, sir.
Thank you very much. And how I
also
nearly got us into hot water.
We are going to have to do an episode on what's the difference between a lasso and a lariat. But we don't have time this time.
Okay, I think the basic difference is there's no such thing as a lasso. It's I believe lasso is only the verb.
Ah.
I believe there is no noun lasso. But we will leave that there. Jim, very quickly, do you have something you want to plug before we go?
Well, we've just mentioned Americans and politics. You did the politics, I mentioned the Americans. So how about, guys, I've got the American Presidents and 100 Facts out at the moment. Takes you all the way through from the time of George Washington to the 2016 election. Last paragraph was my guess as to who would win the election. Read it and find out whether I guessed right. And it's available Amazon or wherever.
And I would just plug there, condensedhistories.com/gems. If you go there, you'll find links to all of mine and Jem's books. I'll give you a clue. There's only one of mine. But you'll find the links there. Follow those links. If you go to that page, click on those links to buy the books. That does give us a little bit of money back. It doesn't cost you anything extra. And it does mean we can continue to support the podcast, keep it moving forward. That's all from us today. Thank you so much to all of you for listening again. Thank you to those people who've been putting up reviews recently on iTunes. That does a massive amount of good. So please keep going and sending your reviews. And of course, most importantly, thank you to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducci.
And thank you to my wonderful co-host, Greg Chapman.
And thank you all for listening. Goodbye and take care.